2 of Budget 2016, a discussion between David Llewellyn-Smith, Leif Van Onselen, and Callum Pickering of CP Economics.
You've said that you're anticipating more than one rate cut. Would you expect a second rate cut to have any greater impact?
Same deal.
Callum, your thoughts?
Yeah, I was going to say that I didn't anticipate there would be much of an effect from this interest rate cut with regards to the housing market. And I think, like David, I don't think, you know, another cut on top of this is going to matter too much. My view has always been that, you know, there's only so much demand from owner occupiers. And I view that demand as being almost exhausted in that there's only so many people who want to upgrade and downsize at any given time. And what we're seeing in mortgage lending markets at the moment is that demand has really come off. It's significantly below its peak now, and it's not just investors. And that suggests to me that demand is weakening. And unless first home buyers begin to enter the market in mass, that's not going to turn around in the near term. And that's going to weigh on house prices over the next, you know, couple of years. And another interest rate cut really isn't going to make much of a difference to that, particularly with APRA being reasonably vigilant against investor lending at the moment. It's hard to see how that market turns around significantly in the near term.
And you've also got to wonder how much of the future interest rate cuts are going to be passed on to by the big banks. Like, we've had all bar ANZ passed on this one in full, but we do know the bank's funding costs are rising, and also gets to the stage where deposit rates can't fall really any lower. So get to the point, I don't know if it'll be next rate cut or the one after, when the banks will basically start withholding a lot of the rate cut.
David, you've been writing about the bank funding costs issue for quite some time. Where do you see that going in terms of what Leith's just talking about?
Sure, well, I mean, we've already seen a number of rate hikes or holding back of rate cuts over the last 12 months, which is about when the global banking spreads started to blow out as the Federal Reserve first tightened up its quantitative easing and then contemplated rate hikes. And then it tipped into commodity markets as China slowed as well, oil especially, which sent global high yield spreads a bit crazy. And as a result, you know, you've seen interest rates for wholesale money for the Australian banks rise quite a lot. From, we had CDS prices around 40 and they've gone to as high as 140 this year. They're at the moment about 105. And, you know, 150, borrowing and lending almost becomes uneconomic. So that gives you an idea of how high they got and, you know, and how much pressure that can put on bank margins. So I expect that as the year goes on, those spreads will probably get worse again. It looks like the oil price, look, it may have bottomed, but it's pretty clear that Saudi Arabia doesn't want the price to rise. US shale is on the verge of rebounding already, and there are good reasons to see oil falling away again. If we can get through, you know, the next few months with the US having reasonable data, you know, before oil topples again, then, you know, we may get another rate hike in the US. And at that point, again, you know, you'll see more upward pressure on the US dollar, more downward pressure on commodity prices, which will also be falling because the Chinese stimulus is beginning to fade. And you'll see those global spreads blowing out again and bank funding costs rising for Australia especially. That's the final point to make, basically, is that Australian funding costs or Australian bank funding costs have risen a lot more than either US or European other developed market funding costs, simply because we're more exposed to commodity prices.
Do you think that scenario was a contributor, along with obviously inflation falling the way it did, to the RBA decision this week?
Oh, look, it would have been, you know, kind of playing on their minds at the margin, but I think, and you probably defer to Callum on this one, but I mean, clearly the inflation number shook them up. Such dramatically falling inflation is raising your real interest rates for everybody, but because it's also indicating something about the state of demand. Yeah. In the economy, you know, when you're getting such broad-based falls in inflation. But, I mean, what was your view, Callum, on the rate cut and the inflation number?
Well, I mean, after the inflation figure dropped, so I considered it almost certain that a cut was coming. It was just a matter of whether it was going to be in May or June. From the bank's perspective, you know, the day before that inflation figure came out, I don't think it would have been in any of their considerations. I don't think they would have thought about cutting interest rates at all. So, I mean, that was really the trigger point. And I think, you know, David made a good point with regards to the real cash rate. And what the RBA has done earlier this week is really only offset some of the, I guess, tightening that's occurred because of the weaker inflation. I calculated that, you know, lower inflation has increased the real cash rate by about 60 basis points over the past 12 months. Yeah, so they're only cutting, you know, less than half of that through their interest rate cuts. So the real cash rate is still well above its sort of trough last year. So, you know, if the RBA is looking at that, then they will certainly be considering another interest rate cut pretty soon.
And you're expecting that?
I am. I think, you know, based on what they've been doing over the past couple of years, I think they'll probably aim for August when they've got a S&P that they can rely on to explain the decision a little bit better. So I think they'll have a couple of quiet months where they'll wait for data to change their mind and then deliver again come August.
And they generally cut in bunches. I don't mean month after month, but they generally do a few cuts.
I'll just come back to you, Callum, there for a look at that inflation. Can you just talk us through where it's coming apart? Is it a couple of key areas or is it across the board?
Look, it'd be really easy to say that inflation fell because of oil prices or because of fruit prices, both of which fell by 10% or more. But the simple fact is that when we look at core inflation or underlying inflation, we can see that there's been a significant downward shift in those measures. And that suggests that the weakness in inflation is far more broad-based than simply a decline in oil prices would suggest. Core inflation was approximately at about a 30-year low, at least a 30-year low, which is quite remarkable. And from my perspective, I've viewed the weakening in inflation over the past couple of years has largely been driven by weaker wage growth domestically. I view this very much as a domestic shock, which is, I guess, fundamentally changing the nature of inflation in Australia at the moment. There's obviously some external factors having an effect, the lower dollar and then more recently the higher dollar, but this is largely a wage-driven phenomenon. And until wages begin to turn around in a significant fashion, inflation is likely to remain low.
If you split it in tradables and non-tradables, they were both falling away. The one that was really striking was the non-tradables, which, as you say, it just kicked into a really powerful downtrend. And even within kind of boom sectors like dwelling construction and what have you, inflation was non-existent. You know, like, so the areas in the economy that are really going strongly even were almost disinflationary. So, you know, there was just, the pulse was really weak.
And the concern from the Reserve Bank's perspective is going to be that this sort of low wage pressures are going to become ingrained in inflation expectations. And the moment that takes effect, it's going to become very difficult for them to get back within their 2 to 3% target band. So if this sort of weak inflation persists over a couple of quarters, they're going to be quite aggressive with their rate cuts. I could quite conceivably see not just another rate cut, but also several more after this as they try to bring inflation back up to a level they're more comfortable with.
Okay, I'm just looking again at the budget outlook. It's calling 2017-18 a CPI figure of 2.25 and a wage price index of 2.75. Is that yet another example of the budget being overly optimistic? And if we take that out to 2019-20, the CPI projection is 2.5 with the wage price index projection at 3.5.
Look, it's a little bit difficult to say given that those projections are so far into the future. I mean, you know, it could happen. I'm not saying it's impossible, but the way the market is set up at the moment, it seems as though wage growth is going to remain weak for some time. And to some extent, it needs to be weak because for a number of years, Australian businesses have become increasingly uncompetitive against its global peers. And so we sort of need to scale that back. And unfortunately, a lot of the heavy lifting is done via weaker wage growth.
Leith, you've been calling an income shock for quite some time now. How long can we expect that income shock to take to play out?
Several years. I mean, I don't know how long's a piece of string, but I can see it being low until, you know, maybe 2020. And the reason why I say that is I think the terms of trade is going to keep falling, notwithstanding the current little mini bounce we've got, but I think it's going to keep trending down for several years. And as long as the terms of trade's trending down, and wages growth's going to bounce around the bottom as well. And it won't be until terms of trade's bottomed and then either starts to pick up again or, you know, has at least hit a bottom before wages growth will return to something more reasonable. Yeah, I think we've got several more years yet. It doesn't mean that there could be a few little rises over the way, but I think we're up for several more years of limp growth in wages.
That's why the budget could claim what it did, is because it, unlike Leith, it, you know, imprudently assumed that the terms of trade falls had stopped. So, I mean, that enabled it to assume a certain amount of income growth going forward. But, of course, if you look at the chart, the terms of trade are still above their highest ever point before the China boom. And so it's an absurd assumption to make that they're going to stay.
And if you actually plot the change in the terms of trade against wages growth, there's a hell of a strong correlation. And we're not just dealing with low wages growth, and the wage price index measures, you know, sort of like-for-like wages, but we're also getting a rotation of jobs away from very high-paid, you know, mining jobs into crappier services jobs, which is actually pulling down weekly earnings growth below wages growth. And I think that's got a lot, you know, got a while longer to play out, this rotation of the economy away from higher paid jobs into services jobs, which pay around 40% less on average.
Okay, David, seeing as we've got an election due in early July, let's go to the politics of it all. Can you see anything coming out of either side of Australian politics, which is likely, from a policy point of view, to start turning around that dynamic?
Yes. If Labor wins, and I actually think they will, despite Bill Shorten, to put it bluntly, their negative gearing reforms are really at their heart. They're actually competitiveness reforms. As Callum was saying, your real exchange rate has just gone up and up and up and up, and you become incredibly uncompetitive. You know, so all your tradable stuff, your exports and import competitors, you know, they're all getting hollowed out. And the negative gearing reform will be a real shock to the system insofar as house prices will simply stop rising the way that they have traditionally. I think that they will actually fall a reasonable amount as well, not calamitously versus baseline, but I think that a bit of froth will come out.
Can I just cut in there, David? If Labor were to get in, and I still think that's up for grabs, but if they were to get in, how desperate do you think they would be to ensure that any falls in nominal house prices on their watch were kept to a bare minimum?
Look, I can see them putting in a first home buyer's grant during that period. But again, it'd only be a temporary reprieve. The bottom line is, I think that the Australian house prices are going to fall no matter what anyone does, henceforth. The indebtedness of Australian households is past its peak. It's not sustainable when, you know, fundamentally, when you can't get any income growth in the economy. But going back to your original point, if you do get that process with negative gearing reform, then you'll simply get lower interest rates, lower dollar, more internal deflation more quickly. You'll get more competitive faster. But obviously that means going lower more quickly before you actually get growth again in your tradable sectors. So, you know, it's a sort of a sharper pain for a quicker rebound in your income growth.
Which is the purpose of reform. I mean, this is what all microeconomic reforms did. Like, you take a bit of short-term medicine and then you get higher productivity growth and higher economic growth and higher living standards later on.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, gentlemen, at the risk of sounding really, really cynical, if you're a strategist inside a party which has just won an election, when would you want that real adjustment taking place?
Well, year one.
Yep.
Year one.
Yep. Year one.
Well, year one starts in about 8 weeks' time. So would you agree that the coming 13 or 14 months for the Australian economy has great potential to be particularly confronting?
Absolutely.
Yeah, well, I could extend and pretend for another, you know, 6 months longer than I expect. Like, maybe we won't see the downturn until halfway through next year. I don't know. But yeah, definitely, I think next year is going to get nasty.
David, you've long written about the age of the global financial cycle and of the sorts of risks which manifest themselves as we get to the very end of that global financial cycle. How do you see us stacking up against that sort of risk at the moment?
Oh, well, I think we're already into it. It's what I've described as the mining GFC, which is nothing more really than an unwind of the chimerican model of growth that the world has enjoyed really since the millennium, which was, you know, ever-strengthening China based on exports and internal development as well that drove commodity prices. And both of those fueled greatly by a current account deficit growth model in the US. So it was sucking in those Chinese exports, had very low interest rates as a result because it was going through a lot of supply side restructuring and offshoring, and therefore had a falling dollar, which was sending a lot of capital into China, commodity prices and emerging markets. But that whole model is now unwinding with the repair, such as it is, of the US economy, the prospect of some slightly higher interest rates and therefore a higher dollar, and China having run through its, you know, basically going ex growth. It's too big now to be a mercantile economy. It's built out by and large in terms of infrastructure and housing. Its urbanization is peaking as we speak. So it's kind of like, you know, the whole world is going through what Australia's been through, which is, you know, the entire global economy was restructured towards this model of growth, like the Australian economy was, which is, you know, everything took a backseat to mining and dirt. And now it's kind of going in reverse. And so it's very difficult for me to imagine that process of unwind happening without an end of cycle shock, which will either be the Federal Reserve goes one step too far and it's tightening, crashes its stock market, and you get a panic that way, or it goes one step too far, the dollar goes too high, oil goes too low, you get a debt shakeout for commodity markets, which is sufficient to derail global credit markets, which is kind of what we toyed with in January, and then that all unravels that way. Or you get something else, like out of the blue, like a Brexit or a Fraxit in Europe, or, you know, China's stimulus fades quicker than even we think it will, because its debt loads now are enormous. You know, all of these things are kind of structural impediments to the business cycle that central banks are fighting with cyclical policy, but structural things are going to win in the end. So I think in the next year, the business cycle will probably end. It's hard to say how exactly, but that's my guess.
That is bloody gloomy, Dave.
Yeah, well, it'll force structural adjustments on everyone, and you'll get fiscal expenditure. Everyone will start spending on infrastructure. And
Callum, do you have any more positive points to add there?
I guess that the broader point is that, you know, if we do manage to go through a significant structural reform process, and that flows through into, you know, micro and macroeconomic reforms from a political level, then we will be in a much better place to, I guess, take advantage of the opportunities that do come our way over the next sort of 10, 20 years. This is sort of that line in the sand moment, similar to, I guess, maybe our last recession, where, you know, that provided the impetus towards competition reform, and we sort of rode that throughout the 90s and early 2000s. And I think we're sort of at that stage again, where we've relied on increasing debt to drive economic growth for so long, and we've also relied on China, obviously, and both those sources of growth are beginning to wind back and turn around, and that's causing us a lot of problems. And when we look at the future, I guess we've got to focus more on how best do we improve productivity growth, because ultimately that's the only long-term source of economic growth, and we should be directing policy towards that. If we can do that, if we can pursue that over the next, say, decade, then the Australian economy will be in a much better place.
And what do you see as the bigger ticket items on the reform agenda which are likely to drive those productivity improvements?
Well, look, based on what the government likes to do, I think that roads is the best way to productivity growth. Look, it's tough to say. I mean, it's always going to be based around infrastructure investment. I mean, that's going to be the core of any government policy towards boosting productivity. I think we've stuffed up the NBN. I mean, that's a bit of a joke at this point. And we've got to make sure that in picking projects in the future that we do a much better job of picking things that are actually going to be beneficial for the Australian economy. I mean, my main concern is that the government just does a dreadful job at picking good projects.
Could you imagine either side of Australian politics being that disciplined in pursuing productivity reform?
Honestly, not really. I mean, just in the last week, we've seen that massive subs deal, which just seems absurd, that surely wouldn't happen in a parliament that was more sensible and more responsible. So, look, my hopes aren't particularly high, but I'm more than happy to be surprised.
I'll take that comment, Callum, as an indicator of the general level of enthusiasm Australians have for their politicians. And with that thought in mind, what are your thoughts about the upcoming federal election? Let's start with you, Dave.
Well, I think the Labor Party's going to win. Or more to the point, I think Malcolm Turnbull's going to lose it.
And what do you put that down to?
Because I think he's plonked himself squarely into the middle of a doom loop. He's only popular because he's a, you know, a centrist, rational, policy-driven politician, and he's adopted a platform that's irrational, far-right, and crazy sort of mad king kind of policies, very much about fear-mongering and everything else. And so every time he opens his mouth on any of these discussions, he gets further alienated from the only reason people like him. And as his polls fall, he has no choice now but to yell everything even louder that people don't like hearing from him. So it's a classic doom loop.
Just before I move on to Callum and Leith, earlier we were talking about the possibility that the iron ore price may play something of a black swan role in the fortunes of both sides of politics in the election campaign. Can you think of any other market or economic data events which may also play that sort of role?
The labour market, so we could get some bad unemployment numbers, which could suddenly jettison the unemployment rate in, you know, 6% or above.
Any event that's likely to cause problems for the government is probably going to come via markets. I'm just not convinced there's enough economic data that could really do significant damage between now and then.
That's a pretty interesting point you make, Callum. There's probably people inside both mainstream sides of politics thinking about those potential risks at the moment. Beyond that, though, who do you think is likely to win?
Look, I think the Liberal Party is going to win despite themselves. I think it's going to be a very close run race. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if we end up with another hung parliament. I mean, much like you guys, I've been pretty disappointed with Malcolm Turnbull since he became Prime Minister, and the Liberal Party more generally. And I think, you know, people didn't just reject Tony Abbott. They also rejected the policies that he was discussing. And when Malcolm Turnbull took over, they sort of hoped that he was going to move the party back to a more moderate position on most areas, and it simply didn't happen. So I think there's going to be a lot of dissatisfaction with the Liberal Party when it comes to polls, and it might be enough for them to lose, but I suspect they might just get over the line.
Leith, your thoughts?
I reckon Labor's going to win with a hung parliament, and the minorities are like, you know, Greens and maybe Xenophon or whoever it is who will side with Labor and form a minority government. Yeah, it's not based on any confidence, purely spitballing.
So, gentlemen, my reading of today's conversation has been that Australia is approaching a point which is going to be critical for the long-term future of its economy, with a budget which is very, very optimistically based, and with an election coming up in 8 weeks' time, which, if I take you guys as being representative of the Australian electorate, may see us have a government without a strong mandate to enact policy to deal with those economic exigencies as they unfold.
That's a certainty, yeah. Whoever wins.
Even if Turnbull gets returned and, you know, with a massively reduced majority and he's just only hanging in there, it's going to totally undermine his authority for the whole next term. So
imagine if Labor won, well, on your scenario, hung parliament. Who would be the Liberal Party opposition leader? Would it be Tony Abbott? They'd be enacting negative gearing reform on this really shaky basis. The ideal guy to put in as opposition leader is Tony Abbott to just smash.
So basically what you're saying is we're heading for a period that's going to be the same as the last sort of 8 years, whatever, where it's just been basically, you know, a random walk of just idiocy.
I'm going to say not going to be as bad as you guys think. I'm going to say that if you guys prove right in this, say, a hung parliament, but the Labor Party gets in through striking a deal with the minority parties, that will be okay because the makeup of the Senate is going to skew left-wing with the Greens holding the balance of power, and that should allow things to be reasonable over the next 3 years. I think the big problem comes if the Liberal Party wins and the Senate makeup is similar to what we've had in the last 3 years, in which case it's going to be mayhem.
And on that profoundly gloomy note, Callum Pickering, Leith Van Onselen, Dave Llewellyn-Smith, thanks very much for your time. You've been listening to Budget 2016, a discussion between David Llewellyn-Smith, Leith Van Onselen and Callum Pickering of CP Economics.